apologize, I don't know where half of my committee is, but we're trying to round them up. We are going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2097 relating to split-use leasing of in-stream water rights. Oh, yay, now we have a quorum. And Beth Petrino is sitting in today for Kat McGinnis, who is ill, and I'm going to ask Beth if she can describe the bill.
House Bill 2097 would repeal the sunset on the authority for split-use leasing of all or a portion of a water right for in-stream use. There should be in front of the committee members a statement of no fiscal impact, there's no revenue impact, and there's no subsequent referral for this bill.
Thank you, Beth. Welcome, Representative Byatt. Thanks for being here. We were waiting for a quorum.
I'm sorry.
Okay. So we have several people that would like to testify on this. And first we're going to hear from the Water Resources Department, Debbie Colbert. On House Bill 2097.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Thank you for inviting me to testify today. And for the record, I'm Debbie Colbert. I'm with the Water Resources Department. And I guess I should start by just mentioning that this is a bill that was introduced by the governor on behalf of the Water Resources Department. And it would remove the sunset on an existing authority or split season leasing program. Just to give the committee a little bit of background, the state has had the authority for existing water right holders to convert their existing rights into in-stream water rights since the 1987 In-Stream Water Right Act. Existing water right holders can convert it either permanently through a transfer, or they can convert it to in-stream use temporarily through a lease. Since we've gotten this authority, especially our in-stream leasing program has grown tremendously. Since back in 1994, I think we had something like 6 in-stream leases. Today, that were active. Today, we have something like 380 that have about 600 cubic feet per second restored in stream through those leases. So the program really has grown in interest since it was originally authorized. In-stream leasing is a voluntary program. Existing water right holders can request to have their water put in stream. One of the requirements of a typical in-stream lease is that while the water right's being leased in stream, the existing use has to stop. And so in the case, for example, of irrigation use, we call it you have to dry up the lands during the time that the lease is being protected in stream. And that's to protect other users from injury and prevent any enlargement of the existing right. So in 2001, the department got additional authority for a new type of in-stream lease called split-season in-stream leasing. And this lease allowed a water user to use their water during a portion of their season and then convert it to an in-stream lease during another portion. So, for example, an irrigator might be able to put water on their lands and get 2 cuttings of hay in an irrigation season and then lease the remainder of their right in stream when flows are lowest in the late summer. So the program can really create some real win-wins for water users and in-stream needs. We haven't had very many of these since it was authorized in 2001. We've had about 7 of them. They've happened in the southwest region of the state, the Deschutes area, and the Willamette. However, we haven't had any occurrences of injury or complaints from other water users, so we think that even though we haven't done a large number of these, the program is working and hasn't resulted in any kind of injury to other rights, and so we're asking to have the sunset removed and continue the authority. I'm happy to answer any questions for the committee.
Okay, well, we're delving into water right law, water right law now, and so a whole new topic of discussion here. Could you maybe explain a little bit of history of in-stream water rights for the committee? Because I think it's an important aspect of water law for them to understand.
Absolutely. As I mentioned, you know, prior to the In-Stream Water Right Act in 1987, the state recognized a certain number of beneficial uses of water that didn't explicitly recognize that water left in stream for things like water quality, recreation, and fish needs were beneficial uses of water. And so that was the really important thing, one of the important things that happened under the In-Stream Water Right. It recognized that leaving water in stream under an In-Stream Water Right was a beneficial use of water. And so since we've gotten that authority, as I mentioned, we have really, I think, as a state, been taking the lead on using these voluntary tools to restore flows. And recently, as part of our performance measures comparison, we've been looking at the quantity of water that has been restored in Oregon versus our kind of other Columbia Basin states. And we've restored something like 600 CFS in stream, and that compares to something like 40 CFS in stream in Idaho and Washington. So I think that Oregon has really shown a lot of success. And one thing to note on the in-stream leasing program in general, I mentioned we've had over 380 of these in place and actually have approved over the history of the program something like 11 applications. We've never had a single complaint of injury on signed leases in that entire time.
Okay, thank you for that clarification, Ms. Colbert. Are there any questions? Representative Burling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess the it helped me a little bit. You know, the summary on this bill as printed says that it's repealing the sunset, which I think is what we find at line 26 on page 1. But what I'm not quite sure of is what exactly are lines 19 through 25 doing? I mean, that doesn't have anything to do with repealing the sunset. So what are we adding by adding those lines?
Madam Chair, Representative, Legislative Council, when they drafted the bill, in order to remove the sunset, they drafted the bill to repeat the language that was added in 2001. So it does repeal the sunset, and because of the way that it had to be drafted, they had to repeat that language that was added in 2001. I hope that answers your question. So this is not new language.
The way it was done.
Well, follow-up.
Follow-up, yes, and then Representative McPherson. So just to clarify, so you're saying this is already in statute?
Madam Chair?
This language is already in statute.
That's correct.
I was here in 2001 when we initially heard this bill, and so this is not necessarily new language, although it's bolded.
Madam Chair, that's correct.
Yeah, I think that briefly. Has a clarification.
Debbie and I have talked about this before, and I spoke with the Legislative Council who drafted this, and it is extremely confusing. But if you look at the bill that was adopted in 2001, that bill had one section that added this language in, another section that took it out for the sunset. And when I asked, well, then why aren't you just repealing the sunset and leaving the language that's in the statute right now alone? And the explanation we got back is that there is a requirement when you do this kind of amending that you show both. I've never seen it done like this before, but that's what Legislative Council has said needs to be done.
Okay. So
it's certainly there.
Yeah.
Verbatim. Identical text.
Right.
Okay, well, good. That's clear as mud.
We could ask somebody from Legislative Council to come and try to explain, but they're probably all busy writing.
We're not going there. Right. I don't want to be the fault of that. No, that's fine. Thank you, Madam.
Representative McPherson, is that your question?
I was just pursuing the same point.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Next, we'll call up. Actually, I'm going to ask Fritz Paulus from the Oregon Water Trust and Doug Myers from Water Watch to come up together, if you don't mind, so we can keep things moving. Welcome, gentlemen. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Fritz Paulus, Executive Director of the Oregon Water Trust. Just for a little background, the Oregon Water Trust was founded in 1993, kind of as a response to the State In-Stream Water Right Act that Ms. Colbert talked about. And we were found as the first of our kind in the nation. Our mission is to restore surface water flows for healthier streams in Oregon by using cooperative free market solutions. In short, we compensate landowners who have water rights to leave all or a portion of their water right in-stream in lieu of using it for an out-of-stream purpose. We focus on smaller tributary streams, primarily where the salmon, steelhead, or bull trout. And these streams are the scale such that if you add a little bit of water to them, there'll be significant ecological benefits. The Trust has pioneered many of the flow restoration tools since the inception of the in-stream water right, from, for example, in-stream leases to transfers to allocations of conserved water to downstream point of diversion changes and voluntary water right diminishments. It's a willing seller program that we operate on. And one of our primary missions is to work with landowners to try to keep land productive and still have flow benefits. In 2006, Oregon Water Trust worked with over 200 landowners to protect 160 cubic feet per second and over 86 streams around the state of Oregon. And part of our effort was honored by the Water Resources Commission in 2006 with a Stewardship and Conservation Award, which basically was for our outstanding commitment to restoring Oregon's water resources for in-stream purposes. I don't need to reiterate what Debbie said about the in-stream leasing law, but we've employed this three times successfully with one landowner in the Rogue Basin. On the back of my written testimony, there's an example of, there's some photos there of what's going on. And what we've done is we, in exchange for a payment to the landowner who's down there with cleaning out his pump in that first picture, he's agreed to shorten his irrigation season, in a most recent example, through July 10th. And thereafter, from July 11th to the end of the irrigation season, the water would be leased in stream. Pursuant to the rules of the Water Resources Department and their interpretation of the statute as it is written, they're requiring measurement of in-stream leases for split-season purpose, and that's why I have that flow meter there on the second photo. And that's a flow totalizer meter, meaning it adds up all the amount of acre feet that is pumped out of that pump. And the reason why that's important is because the way the split-season in-stream lease works is the Department of Water Resources doesn't want to see any enlargement of the water right, and so we need to kind of allocate how much water of the water right is going to be used for out-of-stream purposes and then how much is going to be used for in-stream purposes. So that's what this meter does. It tells us how much water is being used for out-of-stream. And then once that happens, we set a goal of like X amount of acre feet will be used during the irrigation season up until July 10th. And if the landowner is within that rate or that duty, that amount of acre feet, then he can put the rest of the water in stream for in-stream leasing. And then we're giving a certain amount of cubic feet per second that we can protect in stream based on the amount of his water right. So the protections are there against downstream users and other people in the system by metering this water right. And I know there's some concern about that there'd be enlargement of people's water rights, but I think the existing rules about water resources protects any landowner from injury or enlargement. So what we've done is done this in Evans Creek, and it's benefited steelhead and coho salmon. And I think, you know, in the bottom line for us, this tool promotes the efficient and wise use of water. It maximizes the value between out-of-stream and in-stream uses. You know, it allows for agricultural production early in the season when stream flows are higher, and we're protecting in-stream water in-stream at this time might not serve the highest ecological benefit. So it oftentimes makes no sense for us to pay for that early season water because there's plenty of water in the stream if there's adequate runoff. So why not pay for the water late in the season when there's positive ecological benefits, and also we can leave it on the land for positive agricultural benefits early in the season. Those are my comments. And
great.
Okay.
Thank you. And I think we'll hear from Doug next, and then we'll take comments and questions for both of you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Doug Myers, representing Water Watch. Water Watch is an organization statewide that was founded in 1985 and has about 900 members. And we're primarily looking at putting water in stream for fish, for people that like to look at water in stream rather than have a dry stream dry up, and also for pollution abatement and other purposes. It is not true that Fritz and I coordinated our blazer and gray slacks today, but we're doing okay up there. We're in support of this bill. We think it's working, and we like the work that Oregon Water Trust does, and so we're happy to support the bill. And that's the end of my testimony, Madam Chair. I know you like testifiers to be brief.
Well, certainly, if you can say what you can in less words, that's always a good thing. But thank you. Are there any questions for this panel, Representative Cannon?
I have a question, since this is a very new subject to me. I'm curious how you arrive at a price for the water rights, or for the contract, and what that price is, actually.
Good question. Mm-hmm. Payment is based on an estimated loss of productivity from elimination of the late season irrigation. And generally, so we would look, and we use the same type of analysis if it's a full season lease. We would look to see what this irrigator could make irrigating versus not irrigating. And in the example of like split season leasing, usually it's in the context of hay. There's a hay crop, so there can be multiple cuttings, let's say two or three. And so the landowner can cut hay, get a crop to market in the early part of the season, but what is he foregoing in the latter part of the season? And generally it's He can't put enough water on his ground to grow another hay crop, so it's kind of his lost opportunity cost. And it's based on negotiation, and we've been doing this for 14 years now, so we have a good idea of what the price is per acre of the lost opportunity cost.
Is that true not just for the split season leasing, but for the majority of your leasing,
which is exactly
higher rate?
That's right.
And additional follow-up, and what, just give me a rough sense of the cost for one of these leases. I mean, obviously it depends on a whole bunch of things, but.
Well, you know, you can base things on acre feet, cubic feet per second, and acre. For like our average price, not for split season leasing, but just a full season lease, and this is like a running average, is about, you know, $50 to $60 an acre. And it can be higher, though. That's the average. And I think it's a testament to the fact that where the Water Trust is focusing is on good salmon streams where there's some kind of marginal productive ag ground. So, and that's why we can hit that sweet spot where maybe the person who's irrigating that field it's a little rocky, it's maybe not as productive as it should be or could be, but they've just been doing it because that's what their daddy did. But it's next to coho spawning stream, so that's where we're trying to work. What that amounts to, what we paid was $3,400 per CFS for this lease.
Cubic feet.
Thank you. Speaking jargon here. Cubic feet per second. Because that's what we had about 0.9 cubic feet per second is what the in-stream right for this deal on Evans Creek. So we would have paid around $3,600 for him for his late season water. And it was about 54 acres. I don't have my calculator here, but it was 133 acre feet.
And an acre foot is the amount covering an acre that's a foot deep. That's a lot of water.
And committee, I'm thinking we may want to have a water rights 101, which could take about 5 days. I'm thinking I might have Water Resources Department come in and do that at some point. But
thank you for your indulgence.
No, these are good questions, because I think the question about how, you know, fair market value, all this is very, very important. And I think Representative Burley also had a question.
Yeah, I was just curious. Has the trust been active in the trips to the Lower Deschutes?
That's on Buck Hollow Creek was really the first deal Oregon Water Trust did with an actual landowner.
Yeah.
Lease one is in with Jackson County out of the, but they weren't really a person. L2, lease two for Department of Water Resources on Buck Hollow Creek with the most senior water right with a rancher on that stream. And so we continue to lease that in stream, and we're working to long-term arrangement with that landowner. As to the value, that deal, the way we calculated value was exchange hay, replacement hay for water. And it was our first deal, so we didn't necessarily know how to value the water. So he gave up his water right, but he needed replacement hay for his cattle. And so we just figured what would it cost him to go out and buy replacement hay. And that's how we came to the price.
Thank you. Great. Yeah. Any other questions? All right. Thank you, gentlemen.
Okay. Thank you.
I appreciate your testimony.
Yeah.
And our last two people we have signed up is... Actually, I don't know if Richard Kosasan or Nathan, you want to come up instead, or you want to try to... I mean, if you feel comfortable, we're welcome to have you here. And Jim Welsh also signed up. And just make sure and please state your name for the record and who you're representing.
Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, my name is Nathan Reitman. I'm here today on behalf of Water for Life. Water for Life supports the split season program. However, we would ask that you extend the sunset date rather than removing it altogether. As the Water Resources Department testified, there's only been 7 leases in Oregon to date. This program was started in 2001, and basically we just don't think that there's been enough testing of the program, which was the original purpose of the sunset date. And our concern basically is that if too many people use the program, junior water users who are dependent on the return flows of senior water users who have put their rights into split season leases could potentially be injured if the program's used on a wide scale.
Okay, that's it?
That's it.
Okay. Jim?
Chair Dingfelder and committee members, Jim Welsh here for the Oregon Cattlemen's Association. We agree with Water for Life on this. We'd like to see the not see the end of the sunset here. We'd like to continue to test this a little longer for the same reasons. So that's all we have.
Okay. Any questions? This panel?
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Anybody else would like to come up and testify on House Bill 2097? Okay. Well, with that, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2097. And I will open up a public hearing on House Bill 2098. And this is relating to extensions of an irrigation system by the Water Resources, by the Water Resources Commission. I think we have... Beth is going to give a little description, and then the Water Resources Department will come up again and testify.
House Bill 2098 would require that any extension of an irrigation season by the Water Resources Commission be made by rule instead of order. There is, again, with this bill, no fiscal impact, no revenue impact, no subsequent referral. And you should have in front of you a letter that's been submitted as testimony from the Central Oregon Irrigation District.
Thank you, Beth. Tom, welcome. I thought you had retired. Not that I'm happy to see you back, but every session you say you're retiring, so we're fortunate to have you still with the department.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name's Tom Paul, Deputy Director, Oregon Water Resources Department. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on House Bill 2098. This bill proposes to modify Oregon Revised Statute 537-835, which relates to irrigation season extension. Currently, our commission, or the statute, directs that our commission can extend an irrigation season by order, and what we're proposing is that the statute be changed so that the commission extends that season by rule. Generally, water rights authorizing irrigation contain a season of use or a limitation as to when water can be diverted to satisfy those irrigation purposes. Typically, or the range, I guess, of irrigation season begin dates is anywhere from March 1st through early to mid-May. Irrigation seasons also can end anywhere from August through October, quite a variation depending on the adjudication decrees across the state. That's normally where we find the establishment of the irrigation seasons. Often, as you know, in the spring we'll have a dry, long dry period, and there are times when irrigation water is needed prior to the formal beginning of the irrigation season. Same thing is true in the fall. We've had some very, very nice falls where it's sunny and warm, and they extend often into November, and that is beyond the irrigation season, and we have times when water is needed to satisfy irrigation needs then during that extended fall time. Requests for extending an irrigation season may be filed only by the Oregon Department of Agriculture. They're the authorized requester. Those requests go to the Water Resources Commission. Currently, the APA says that for the Administrative Procedures
Thank
Act.
You. Thank you. Glad that you're on.
I apologize for that.
Yeah. We're going to start putting the piggy bank up here like Representative Crummell did for all the acronym users.
Madam Chair, I think Debbie will be doing the rest of our testing. The Administrative Procedures Act says that for an order to be effective, it has to be served on a person. The APA, the Administrative Procedures Act, goes on to say that serving an order on an agency director, or staff of an agency does not qualify as serving it on a person. So what we are finding is we're having a difficult time identifying who we need to be serving these orders on. The rule process would allow notice, rulemaking hearings, public process. Time-wise, we think we can accomplish and be as responsive to the needs with the rule process as we are with the order. There is a way for a commission to approve temporary rules. Those temporary rules are in place for 180 days, and what we would propose is that once our commission acted on a temporary rule, we would initiate the permanent rulemaking at the same time. One thing about this proposed legislation, it does not change any of the protections that are currently contained. In order for our commission to approve an extended season, water must be available. It can't injure existing or future water rights. In-stream flows for aquatic resources and for water quality are protected. So this bill would not change that. I'd be happy to take any questions at this time.
Actually, I'm going to ask the Department of Agriculture, I didn't realize you're in the room, to also come up and give testimony. If you can stay here, and then we have both agencies up here in case there are any questions. Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Sorry, I didn't see you back there.
That's okay. Thank you, Chair. For the record, my name is Jim Johnson. I'm the Land Use and Water Planning Coordinator for the Oregon Department of Agriculture. Real quick, because Tom covered most of this, the department, of course, supports this bill. Well, we're not the decider. We are the requester in these situations, and we're usually, in many ways, the first point of contact for individuals that are looking to extend an irrigation season. What we're finding is this is becoming, well, not a common day occurrence. It's becoming more common in that people are looking at this, and it relates a lot to not only the obvious things, that be the change, some of the changes we're having in climate and weather and the like, but also really the very nature of Oregon agriculture, in that it's a very diverse industry, over 220 different commodities produced in the state, and there's probably that many practices associated with most of those commodities. So when you take that into account with changing weather and climate, and you take into account just the fact that we're finding new crops all the time that have different needs, we really are finding that we need this flexibility to be able to extend irrigation seasons when merited through the rule.
Okay. All right, thank you. Any questions for this panel? Representative Burley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Tom, thank you for your testimony. You did a great job explaining, answering my question. I didn't even ask it yet, and that really is why we're doing this. But I am just one concern here, and that's the time frame. I mean, rulemaking is, well, I'm not going to say painfully slow necessarily, but can take some time. So is this something that you'd probably do through emergency rules, just to expedite it?
Madam Chair, Representative Burley, initially we would use a temporary rule process, which our commission is authorized to go forward with temporary rules and act very quickly to approve those. Those temporary rules will stay in place for up to 180 days. We would initiate the permanent rulemaking during that same time period, so at the end of the 180 days, we should have a permanent rule in place.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? No? Okay, we have a couple more folks who want to testify. Thanks, but stick around in case we need you. Actually, Scott Ashcombe from the Oregon Agricultural Alliance, and I'll ask Doug Myers from Water Watch to come up. We'll start a new trend here. Hi, Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Scott Ashcombe with the Oregon Agricultural Alliance. We are a general farm organization statewide in Oregon, and my nurseries and ranchers and row crop growers use a significant amount of irrigation and nursery use water. We are in opposition to House Bill 2098 at this time. I want you to understand that we support the work that the Water Resource Department and the Water Resource Commission does. They're an excellent agency, and my comments are in no way critical of anyone in the agency. They do a fine job, and we support what they do. The requirement that irrigation season is only to be accomplished by order of the commission is, to us, it just makes a lot of sense. It's an old law, and it works very well. It's not broken, and we don't believe that it needs to be fixed. We think there are very good reasons for the notification requirements of an order. That when you take into account the dollar value of the crops that can be burned up and lost because of an extended summer heat wave that moves outside of the irrigation season, and you consider the potential liability for that loss of crops if water, in fact, is available in the stream late in the season after the irrigation season has expired. We think you see the reason for the wisdom for notification by service of an order of the commission. The question of whether or not extending the irrigation season by order or extending the irrigation season by administrative rule is more effective and can be done more quickly and more efficiently, I submit, having done it been involved in such proceedings myself, that by an order of the commission is much more efficient, it's much more rapid, and it's much more effective than an administrative rule. You don't have the statutory time guidelines that you have in an administrative rule with regard to an order. The last time that I was asked by, in this particular case, it was the Oregon Farm Bureau Federation, to go before the then Water Policy Review Board, I believe, was 1983 or 1984. We had a summer that basically featured 93 degree weather in early November, And so I was directed by my boss to go to the Water Resource Commission and ask for an extension of the irrigation season. That order was issued within a matter of days. I don't know whether the department served anybody or not, as they're required to do. But the fact is that the irrigation season was extended. It was extended in short order. The farmers who could have had their crops destroyed were not. They didn't have to wait 30 days or 60 days, as they would have had to wait under an administrative rule. So under that, we're going to take the conservative position. We believe that this is a good statute as it is. Irrigation season should be extended by order. I might add that if you look at the line 9 of the bill and you're reading existing statute, the Water Resource Commission can already extend the irrigation season by rule, if I read it correctly. But I say please don't change it from an order to a rule, and we're in opposition to the bill. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Doug Myers again with Water Watch. We are neutral on the bill. We don't have any opposition to it, nor do we support it. And I cannot, if you're going to ask me, Madam Chair, I cannot answer Scott's. When you get me up here, I have a number of other clients in the building, and I'm not the brains of the outfit, as we talk about Water Watch. Mm-hmm. So you're not here to.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it. So you're neutral on this. I would like to actually ask, and you can stay up there if you want or not, Anita Winkler from the Oregon Water Resource Congress to come up, because we have a letter. I think is it from one of our members? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I wanted to have her come up. And
Mr. Ashcombe?
Don't go away yet. I wanted to just have her come up so she could talk about letter, and then we'll take questions. Thank you.
Chair Dingfelder and members of the committee, I'm Anita Winkler. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Water Resources Congress. And I'll do, since other people have mentioned it, we'll do a little bragging. We're celebrating our 95th anniversary this year. We represent irrigation districts and other organized systems that deliver water to irrigation water throughout the state of Oregon. You have in front of you some testimony from Steve Johnson, who's the manager of the Central Oregon Irrigation District, which I believe is the largest irrigation district in Central Oregon and one of the largest in the state. And rather than reread all of his testimony, our organization has not taken a formal position on this bill, relying on the districts who have a specific interest to contact their legislators and let them know of their interest. But we do support Steve Johnson's testimony. We believe that this is a good way to do business. And frankly, the notification procedures that are required currently for this kind of an extension we think are pretty onerous. We support the department in their efforts to try and, if you will, simplify, it's a poor choice of words, but simplify a process that when it needs to happen fairly quickly.
Okay, thank you, Nina. I appreciate you coming up. I think Representative Burley has a question.
Well, I do. Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Ashcombe, that's exactly why I asked Tom from Water Resources about, you know, the time frame. And perhaps, Madam Chair, we could have him come back up, because I want to flush this out some more so that, you know, there's some comfort level here. I understand exactly your concerns. I'm reading this from Central Oregon Irrigation District, and I'm trying to reconcile all
right.
this stuff.
Well,
so could you touch on that some more, please? Time frame, if we were to do this by rule.
Okay. Madam Chair, Representative Burley, again, there are two processes for adopting rules, for a commission to adopt rules. One is the temporary rule process. The other is permanent rule. Permanent rule does take quite a long period of time. By the time you submit notice, hold the hearing, consider the comments that are received, go back to the commission then for adoption, it can be quite lengthy. With a temporary rule, we could take a package to our commission explaining what the need is, why it is an immediate need. Emergency, I think, is one phrase that has been used. They would then weigh the impacts, weigh the information and testimony during that commission meeting, and make a decision as to whether or not to move forward. time-wise, it would be very similar to putting a rule before them and having them to discuss that and act as to whether or not to adopt that rule. So the temporary or order, I'm sorry.
Could we?
I'll back up.
Rewind that a little bit.
I will, because I confused.
I was waiting to hear that word, but I didn't.
the temporary rule, again, the staff would take a staff report to the commission, very much the same as we take a staff report for an order. They would review them basically the same. They would take public comment at the same time. And then they would act, in the case of a temporary rule, they would act to adopt that temporary rule. In that particular instance, we would also be recommending that the commission direct staff to go forward with a permanent rulemaking process. With the order, it does end at that point. Our commission considers the order, decides whether or not to issue an order. If they issue, then it's the next step that is somewhat confusing. As I mentioned, you cannot serve an order on an agency director because an agency director by Administrative Procedures Act is not a person. And for an order to be effective, you have to serve upon a person. So it would involve identifying who we needed to serve the order on. We do not have names and addresses of the water right holders on in a basin. And we could have, depending on the size, we could have hundreds or thousands of individuals who hold water rights. We have extended a season in the North Saint Iam, which involves all of Saint Iam Water Control District plus many other users. We have extended a season in Hood River, so it would be all of the water right holders in Hood River.
And how many? So that would be hundreds, thousands? Can you give us a sense?
It would probably be thousands. Madam Chair, a basin that you're familiar with, the Tualatin, also has an extended season. And there are probably tens of thousands of individuals in that basin which hold water rights.
Can you follow up?
Thank you. When I read Central Oregon Irrigation District's letter here, they say, for example, the district has several patrons that have moisture-sensitive crops. Now, I would imagine COID's got hundreds or thousands of patrons, but am I correct then when I'm reading this that out of all of those patrons at Central Oregon Irrigation District, maybe only a handful are asking for an extension of the season? Is that correct, or does the whole district get the extension?
Madam Chair, Representative Burley, it may be a handful that actually have the immediate need and go forward, but the process is to extend the season in a basin or sub-basin. The request would go to the Oregon Department of Agriculture, and then Oregon Department of Agriculture would consider it and would forward information to us, a recommendation to us, as to the size of the area that was being proposed.
So the
follow.
Thank you.
You're
sorry.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Just for the record,
the order then. I mean, even though they may only have a few patrons that have moisture sensitive crops, the order is not going to those few patrons. It's going to everybody in the basin.
Madam Chair, Representative Burley, the extended seasons that our commission has approved in the past have gone to an area rather than specific individuals.
Okay, and one last follow-up.
Sure.
Thank you. I'm having a memory lapse here.
Okay.
Where was I going with that?
Well, why don't we let Representative McPherson,
okay,
and
you.
Then there might be another
thank you.
Time when it comes back.
Mr. Paul, I'm just having trouble with the language of the bill and trying to parse it. Because it maybe you can help me through it here. Leaving out the notwithstanding clause, it's in the upon receipt of a request clause, is the Water Resources Commission may by, and then we would strike out order and add rule, extend the irrigation season of a sub-basin beyond the period established by adjudication. So that's the extension. And then there's this text here before the colon, which now says administrative rule or by condition imposed on a permit or certificate. So I think that's
straight up struck out, is taken out.
I understand that's being stricken, but under the existing this goes to a point that was made here earlier, whether an administrative rule would already be available as an alternative to the order, although I'd say it's not a model of drafting in the existing statute, but I'm not sure it's cured by the proposed the bill language. Regarded under existing law as being an option to do it by administrative rule as an alternative to order?
Madam Chair, Representative McPherson, what that particular paragraph is addressing is how the irrigation season is identified. And typically, well, about two-thirds of the state of Oregon has gone through a water rights adjudication. And in those adjudications, generally, the courts have identified what the irrigation season is. For areas that have not been adjudicated, or about one-third of the state, we did adopt an administrative rule that identified the irrigation season as March 1st through October 31st. So where it says administrative rule, that's really identifying a pretty small area of the state of Oregon.
Do you have a follow-up?
Can I try to clarify, Madam Chair? I think that the Representative McPherson's pointing out the confusion here, and the way I understand it is that, I'm trying to put it into words, but that there are certain ways in which the irrigation season was established. They include adjudication, which we've just heard was most of the state, administrative rule or rule, as you're proposing we amend it, and the third is condition imposed on a permit or certificate. So that's a separate change, if you will, than the one that we're primarily making, which has to do with changing order to rule.
So, Representative McPherson, are you saying that by the way you read the existing language, that's already an option to do a permit?
Well, I think it could be read that way, I'd say it's confusing, I think, in the existing text. And one of the other witnesses was suggesting, well, they can already do it by rule. But it does say administrative rule, although I don't know that that is limiting in any meaningful way.
Madam Chair, Representative McPherson, the legal question is whether we can adopt an administrative rule which changes existing adjudicated water rights. Mm-hmm. And I don't believe we can. Where it says administrative rule, that's only addressing those areas that have not been adjudicated. The bill further goes on to say, specifically to extended season, that our commission can change that by order, and that order would modify irrigation seasons that have been set either through an adjudication or by rule or potentially by permit, water rate permit condition. I think it is two different
now
areas.
I beg your pardon. Now I see the reading. The point is that the way that the season that's getting its extension was established is by either adjudication, by mm-hmm. administrative
or
rule. Okay. Now I do follow it now. So it the effect of the bill is to replace, to introduce a rule as an option that would not exist now. I got it.
Madam Chair, may I just make a comment? We're not objecting to the notion that the notification requirements by service for this order of the commission to extend the irrigation season couldn't be done in a more modern, more effective, more cost efficient way than this old statute. We believe it's a good statute, but this is a fairly old statute. And the statute contemplates service by certified mail and so forth, and that causes a significant expense for the department. I've heard complaints as far back as early 1980 from department directors, then called the state engineer and so forth, that requirement is onerous, and for the reasons that Tom has brought before you, it's tough. It can be done in a better way, but we believe that the code shouldn't be amended to bring that about. Amend the Administrative Procedures Act. And I know it sounds like a cop-out, but really, I think that it could be done more effectively, more efficiently that way, and allow a kind of notification, say, in the newspaper of record in the basin or in the sub-basin, in three successive weeks, and even specify the size of the ad and the content of the ad, notify the everybody in the basin in a more efficient way than this old statute requires. But we don't think you should change the code.
Representative Burley has a follow-up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My memory came back. I apologize for that. For my lapse not coming back. But that's exactly where I was trying to go with my line of question, because, and I'm not as familiar with state rulemaking as the federal process, but if you, in the federal process, they can issue a final interim rule, and there's no further rulemaking, and that rule goes away after X months or whatever the time period is. Under Oregon's rulemaking process, if you issue a temporary rule, as you referred to it, do you necessarily have to go through then the subsequent and more time-consuming, because this is an impact then to the agency process of issuing a final rule, or can you just do a temporary rule, mm-hmm. similar to an order, bam, you're done and that's it, no more physical impact, no more time, no more effort on that issue?
Madam Chair, Representative Burley, we can walk away with just a temporary rule. However, if the water users, the irrigators, find themselves needing water before or after the season in subsequent years, we would have to go through that temporary rulemaking process each time. Because, again, the temporary rule can only last for 180 days.
Well, Madam Chair, we spent 50-some pages on the biofuels, and I don't think had this much discussion.
Welcome to Western Water Law. So, any other questions for this panel?
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Anybody else that would like to testify on House Bill 2098? Okay. Well, with that, we will close the hearing on House Bill 2098. Moving right along here, we will open up a hearing on House Bill 2099, and that is relating to the refund of protest fees by the Water Resources Department Director. I actually thought we'd have some easy bills for. Yeah. Nothing is easy in water law.
Water.
Tom, you're back. First, Beth can give us an overview of the bill.
House Bill 2099 would allow the Water Resources Department Director to refund all or a part of a protest fee if an order of the Commission establishes that all or a part of a water right is not canceled or modified. There is no revenue impact, a minimal fiscal impact, and no statement was issued.
Okay, and we have Tom Paul and Doug Myers who want to testify on this. So I don't know, if I were you, I would think about retiring after this session, Tom.
Madam Chair, I will be visiting with Debbie Colbert after this. She assured me that these two bills would just be very simple and limited discussion.
Well, I had the same discussion, so this has been very interesting.
For the record, Tom Paul, Deputy Director, Oregon Water Resources Department. Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify on House Bill 2099. This bill proposes to allow for refund or partial refund of protest fees that are paid associated with a challenge to a water right. And when I say challenge, it's a challenge of forfeiture to an existing water right. Currently, any person can submit affidavits alleging that a water right has been forfeited. And when I say forfeited, the statute says a water right that goes for five or more consecutive years of non-use is considered forfeited. If we receive two affidavits attesting to the fact that water has not been used on a parcel for those five or more consecutive years, we will review what is submitted. We will make sure that all of the information that we need to go forward is included, so there is somewhat of a review process. We either accept those affidavits and go forward with a notice of proposed cancellation, or we return the affidavits to those who file them and indicate that we need additional information. We average about a dozen water right challenges a year. Year before last, I think we had 15 filed. Last year it was about 11. About half of the affidavits, or about half of the cases, we return the information and affidavits requesting additional details. Quite often, there is no follow-up then. The individuals do not return those documents to us. Once the water right holder is notified of the cancellation or proposed cancellation, they have an opportunity to protest the cancellation of their water right. Now, there is no fee associated with filing the affidavits. However, the water right holder must pay a $250 protest fee in order to challenge the cancellation of his water right. What this bill would do would be to give us the ability to refund all or a portion of the protest fee if the water right holder is successful in defending the water right. When we go through a contested case hearing, well, I'll back up a minute. I mentioned that about half of the challenges are returned, so that leaves us about a half a dozen that we go forward with. And then of the half a dozen, again, about half of those are not protested and end up in cancellation. The others are scheduled for contested case when we go forward. When we go through a contested case hearing process, it is lengthy. It involves testimony, very much a court-like setting, and it is not uncommon that a portion of a water right may be canceled through that. Sometimes the entire right, but generally it's just a portion, and that's where we're getting a part of the fee or all of the fee for refund. I'd be more than happy to take questions at this time.
Tom, could you, especially for the newer members, explain what a cancellation of a right is and entails? Because, and I apologize, we probably will have a Water Rights 101, although, like I said, it could take several weeks to do that, but I think it's important for folks to understand what the concept is.
I'll give you a very, very abbreviated 101 here, Madam Chair. In order to use water in the state of Oregon, individuals have to obtain a water right. That's either done through using water prior to Oregon water law, and you go through an adjudication and the courts establish what the water rights are, or you file a water right application with Oregon Water Resources Department. Permit is issued, and then you have a time period in which to perfect use under that permit. Either through an adjudication or through the permit process, eventually a water rights certificate is issued, and that water rights certificate describes what the water can be used for. It gives some other key elements: priority date, source, quantity, maximum rates, duties, or the quantities of water that can be diverted. Once that water rights certificate is issued, that water right's there forever. It's not renewed like some other agencies, say DEQ, Department of Environmental Quality, with a discharge permit. That permit is issued, and about every 5 years they go through a review process where it's reissued. With a water right, that water right certificate's issued once, and it stays there. It stays with the land. That water right is good as long as it is used beneficially under the terms and conditions of that water right certificate. A water right that goes five or more years of non-use is considered forfeited, and so can be lost or canceled through that process.
Do you want to throw in first in time, first in right? Do you want to go there?
That will be on phase two.
Okay, thank you. That was excellent, Tom. I really appreciate that. And also, Oregon's water laws date back to 1909, which we're coming up to the centennial. Is that correct?
We are, Madam Chair. We're looking forward to the 100-year birthday coming up in two more years. 97 years old, or 98 years old right now.
So. Okay. Thank you. Are there any questions?
Very quickly. Thank you, Madam Chair. Just out of curiosity, the affidavits that are filed, are they filed, can they be filed anonymously?
Madam Chair, Representative Burley, no, they cannot be. We can always receive, as an agency, we can receive information that may prompt us to go on our own and look. We can initiate the forfeiture process as an agency, but typically, with the limited number of field staff we have, they're not on the parcels of land with water right on a regular basis, so they can go to a contested case hearing and testify that they know water was never used beneficially. You know, it's a pretty high burden of proof.
Okay.
So when an affidavit comes into us, one of the qualifiers is you're submitting this information. Are you willing to testify in a contested case hearing? And if they say no, then that normally gets returned to them.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions? Mr. McPherson, Representative McPherson. No questions?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I know you went to law school, but this wasn't your area of law, so leave that to the other attorneys at Stolbury.
Groping around here a bit.
Okay.
That's fine.
Thank you so much, Tom. And Doug Myers from Waterwatch.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My sympathies to those of you trying to figure out the arcane world of water. It grew out of water grew out of mining in California, and what you're—I don't mean to be vulgar—but what this bill is all about is what we call the use it or lose it rule. You have to use your water right or you lose it, and it's real hard to modify or to lose a water right. It goes on forever, which is why Waterwatch is as Tom and Debbie can tell you. Are the really watchdogs of the department issuing water permits that eventually get into certificates, as Tom was explaining, that go on forever and ever and ever. It's not like a DEQ discharge permit, as Tom was saying, where you can look at it every 5 years. This is known as a doctrine of prior appropriation, and it's kind of holy writ. And we're not going to put a bill in to take a look at that, but in today's modern world, it doesn't make a lot of sense. And what the three people to the chair's left are doing very intelligently is reading bills and trying to make some sense out of them, and sometimes you just can't. Because, and I know from personal experience, I really feel sorry for Tom. If he weren't such a gentle soul, Debbie got him up here from his last two bills, he would be in the back row with his hands around her throat right now.
Thank you for that explanation. And I've been working on water law for 20 years, and I learn something new every day.
Yeah. It is very, very, very complicated and arcane. And
and I'm not an attorney. I just want to make sure for the record people know that. Okay.
But Waterwatch is neutral on the bill. You can. We don't oppose it. We don't support it. Be happy to see it passed. So that's the end of my testimony, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Myers? Thank you. Anybody else who would like to come up and testify on House Bill 2099? Don't see anybody rushing up to the witness stand. So with that, I will close the hearing on House Bill 2099. And I will open up a hearing on, what's our last bill? House Bill 2100. Beth, would you like to... Did you guys flip a coin for this one? This is for the use of water for non-emergency firefighting training.
House Bill 2100 does exactly that. It allows for the use of water for non-emergency firefighting training, so that use will be exempt from the requirements for a water right. There is no revenue impact, no fiscal impact, and there is no subsequent referral.
Okay, thank you. Do we have anybody who wants to testify? Oh, Ms. Colbert, would you like to come up? And actually, I'm also going to invite Paul Bell from the Department of Forestry to come up as well. Welcome back.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Again, for the record, I'm Debbie Colbert with the Water Resources Department. And before I provide testimony, I think I would just echo what the Chair has said. Every time I listen to Tom talk about Oregon water law, I learn something new. And we talk about how the water code is almost 100 years old, and Tom's been working for our department about a third of that.
I'm glad you didn't say 100 years. I would have started really worrying.
So thank you again. House Bill 2100 is, again, a bill that the governor has introduced on behalf of the department, and it would amend the statute. As Tom mentioned, there generally any use of groundwater and surface water in the state requires a right to use that. There are limited exemptions to that that requirement to get to make application to the Water Resources Department. The House Bill 2100 deals with the section of the statute mostly focused on exempt uses of surface water, and it includes things like firefighting or exempt uses of surface water. There's also a section of this statute that refers to non-emergency firefighting training, and it puts some sideboards on that as an exempt use of surface water, but it limits it specifically to firefighting training that's conducted by rural fire protection districts and public fire departments. This bill would propose to eliminate that specification and extend this exemption to any entity that's conducting this kind of firefighting training. And really, the reason why we pursued this concept originally is just a recognition that there's a lot of entities around the state that are doing firefighting training, like the Oregon Department of Forestry, the Oregon Military Department. And in fact, a couple years ago, our water master had the opportunity to tell the Oregon Military Department that they could not conduct firefighting training on the North Santiam. So it really grew out of some specific instances where these types of groups were doing very legitimate firefighting training and wanting to work with our department, and there really was no means under the current statute to work with them to allow that use as proposed. I mentioned there's some sideboards on using it under this exempt use. If it's stored water, you have to have permission of the owner of the stored water. If it's any other source, you have to work with the water master, and the water master has the authority to condition the use to prevent any injury to other water rights and to also prevent impacts to in-stream resources. So, for example, if the Department of Forestry, under the amended statute, came forward and was planning some training activities in Southwest Oregon, they can work with our water master, understand kind of what streams might be appropriate locations to do the training, and help them do their training during times and periods when there's sufficient water available so that there won't be negative impacts on the resource or other rights. So that concludes my testimony. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Okay, thank you. I think we'll hear from the Department of Forestry first and then see if there's any questions from the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify. I'm Paul Bell, Assistant State Forester with the Oregon Department of Forestry. The department supports House Bill 2100 and commends the Water Resources Department for addressing this issue and reaching out to help ODF. The suggested changes make it clear Oregon Department of Forestry, the National Guard, and private firefighting organizations can perform hands-on training exercises to become more proficient at firefighting suppression. So, thank you.
Great. Thank you so much for coming. Appreciate your testimony. Are there any questions for this panel? Representative Cannon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Would either of you care to speculate why the original drafters of this bill included this restriction to public fire departments and rural fire protection districts?
Madam Chair, Representative, I don't know the history of why it was only those organizations that were specified at that time. I'm sorry.
Well, maybe since Tom has been around almost as long as Oregon Water Law, maybe we can ask Tom to come up and see if he can illuminate for us. I'm going to be in big trouble after this one. You got me started.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. For the record, Tom Paul, Deputy Director, Oregon Water Resources Department. And it's quite a step to adopt exceptions to Oregon water law to allow uses. Initially, the exception was limited to emergency firefighting. We were contacted by some fire agencies, and the fire agency said, you know, or actually I think we contacted the fire agencies because one of our water masters went out and observed the removal of water from a stream, and it was a fire entity that was taking water and using it for training purposes. So we were approached by, and I don't recall the group, but it was a public firefighting entity saying, we need to have the ability to use water for training purposes. We're pumping the water out, we're spraying it, we're taking very little, and for the most part, we're right at the water body, so it's ending up back in the same source. There was no discussion about how broad a world we were looking at when it comes to firefighting. The statute was amended to include emergency firefighting, and the next thing we know, we have contract firefighters that also train and prepare for fighting emergencies. So one step at a time, and they're small steps.
Thank you for that clarification. Any other questions? Thank you. Next, I'd like to invite Mr. Caldwell up, please. If you could state your name and affiliation or address for the record, please.
Madam Chairman and members of the committee, I'm Brigadier General Mike Caldwell. I'm the Deputy Director of the Oregon Military Department. As was stated in previous testimony, I've handed in some testimony for you, but I think I'll just summarize it by saying that it was very well articulated by the previous group. We typically train our helicopter pilots, try to do this in the spring, and when there's usually quite a little bit of water resources out there. As was indicated, several years ago, we were stopped from doing this because of the statutory language that we were unaware of. And what occurred was basically between deployments and no on-the-job training, if you will, during the fire season when they could do it, we ended up with a whole bunch of pilots that were not qualified to do the job that we were asked to do. To answer Representative Cannon's question earlier, I have no idea why we weren't added in before, but my guess is that previous to about 1994-95, we had UH-1 Vietnam-era helicopters, and they couldn't haul much water. They were just not powerful enough to do that. And until we got the Blackhawks in the mid-90s, we were not much of a force to help with actually putting water on a fire. That's my educated guess as to why this never arose before the late 90s. And then again, when you have gaps in fire years where you don't have many fires, you might go 2 or 3 years where we essentially would not be involved in fires because we're the last agency called in when all the contract resources are expended somewhere else in the region or the nation, and then we'll come into the fire. We're the first ones to leave, so we're not competing with private industry. So given all those factors, on occasion, you need to prepare, but if you can't go out and teach these pilots how to do that and they get the practice of the load that they lift and how to expend that load and how to put it and place it where the people on the ground want it, then we're pretty ineffective. And it becomes a safety issue as well. So if we can't get this training in and these pilots can't get in, the crews can't get the feel of all of this activity, then we're risking their lives and that machinery in order to do this. So the training is really essential that we be able to do that, and that was the whole essence behind us working with the Water Resource Division and trying to find a solution that we could do to get this training in with our pilots. So beyond that, I put some data in there with respect to how much water we take out and what kind of helicopters we have, and certainly welcome to look at that, but it's not a tremendous amount of water. It's more, and usually what we do is we pick it up and put it back where we got it. But they need that experience and feeling that weight and how that whole apparatus works. So I'll conclude my testimony pending any questions you may have.
Great, thank you. Thank you very much for coming here today. Are there any questions? Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. And last we have Doug Myers from Water Watch. last but not least, I should say. Thank you, Doug.
Thank you again, Madam Chair. As a member of the committee, my name is Doug Myers, representing Water Watch. I know there are some in the room who will not believe what I'm saying, but the bill makes sense. Water Watch supports it. Thank you.
And you are on record. Thank you. Appreciate it. Okay. Any questions for Doug before he leaves? Okay.
Madam Chair, if I may, just one question.
Mm-hmm.
I notice there's no effective date in this bill. It's
so it would become effective January 1.
Okay, yes. Thank you. Just wanted to get that clear.
Yep.
Madam Chair, I'd also note this is a good reminder to read past the summary, since the summary of this bill really does not indicate what the bill actually does. And
right.
Just
you're
a good
absolutely,
reminder.
Absolutely correct. Any other questions before we close this hearing? Okay. With that, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2100. And committee members, since we've posted for a work session, I am going to open up a work session on House Bill 2097. And I would entertain a motion.
Madam Chair, 97, you said, correct?
House Bill 2097.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2097 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, Representative Burley moves House Bill 2097 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Okay. So those of the opinion that House Bill 2097 should be reported to the floor with a due pass recommendation will vote aye. Those opposed vote no. The clerk will call the roll.
Representative Smith?
Excused.
Representative Byer?
Aye.
Representative Jensen?
Excused.
Representative Burley?
Aye.
Representative
Cannon?
Aye.
Representative
McPherson? Aye. Chair Dingfelder? Aye. Okay. So, the motion carries. Having received, the required majority is declared passed. And who would like to carry the bill? Don't all jump up at once. Maybe we should ask Tom if he'll carry the bill. Representative Cannon?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I'd be happy to carry the bill.
I think that since it's it is usually the tradition of the first bill out of the committee, we usually have the freshman carrying it, and since I think you're the only freshman here.
There are other traditions pertaining to freshman bills, and this is a wonderful way to begin.
Okay,
thank you.
So with that, Representative Cannon has volunteered to carry the bill. And I will close the work session on House Bill 2097, and I will open up the work session on House Bill 2098.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2098 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, Representative Burley moves House Bill 2098 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Are there any discussions? Okay, seeing none. Those of the opinion that House Bill 2098 moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation will vote aye, and those opposed vote no. The clerk will call the roll.
Representative Smith, excused. Representative Byer?
Aye.
Representative Jensen, excused. Representative Burley?
Aye.
Representative Cannon?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Aye. So the bill having received, or the motion having received the required majority is declared pass. And who would like to carry this bill?
Representative Smith would, I think.
Glad to do that in abstention. I actually was going to ask Representative McPherson if he would.
I'd be delighted to.
Since he had parsed out the word so carefully and I think has a clear understanding of what this means. So just in case anybody does happen to ask a question. Thank you, Representative McPherson. So with that, Representative McPherson will carry the bill, House Bill 2098, to the floor. And we will close the work session on House Bill 2098. And I will open up a work session on House Bill 2099.
Madam Chair, I move that House Bill 2099 be placed on the consent calendar.
Okay, first we have to vote on it, though.
Yeah.
I knew that. I was just testing.
Shouldn't laugh. I'm sorry. But that's a good suggestion for after we vote.
I'll start over again.
Okay.
Rewind. Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2099 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you, Representative Burley. And Representative Burley moves House Bill 2099 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Are there any discussions on this bill?
Madam Chair, just a comment. I had someone kindly come into my office to give me a very brief history of water rights that made this sound so simple. And I'm wondering if what we're doing today is part of the reason why it's not so simple anymore. But, I think they were kind enough to come and visit me because I said I have never dealt with water rights before. And so I had this nice little briefing, but it still is much more complicated than they led me to believe.
Well, thank you for sharing those comments, Representative Byers. I said welcome to Western Water Law, and that's why we have the experts who come up and try to explain some of the intricacies. But I would be happy to actually, I think we will have a little bit of Water Rights 101 in the next week, and we'll be having some folks from the department, and we'll also be having some folks from OSU that will come in as well. So, and I have lots of material in my office, so if any of you ever would like to do some extra reading, I have some excellent primers, actually, on Oregon water law. So any other discussion? Okay, those are the opinion that House Bill 2099 should be reported to the floor with a due pass recommendation. We'll vote aye. Those opposed vote no. The clerk will call the roll.
Representative Smith, excused. Representative Byer.
Aye.
Representative Jensen, excused. Representative Burley.
Aye.
Representative Cannon.
Aye.
Representative Burson.
Aye.
Aye. The motion, having received the required majority, is declared passed. And I would entertain a motion for consent calendar.
Madam Chair, I move that House Bill 2099 be placed on the consent calendar.
Representative Burley moves that House Bill 2099 be placed on the consent calendar. Is there any discussion? Okay, those of the opinion that House Bill 2099 should be placed on the consent calendar will vote aye. Those opposed vote no. The clerk will call the roll.
Representative Smith, excused. Representative Byer? Aye. Representative Jensen, excused. Representative Burley?
Aye.
Representative Cannon? Aye. Representative McPherson? Aye.
Aye. The motion, having received the required majority, is declared passed. And with that, I will close the work session on House Bill 2099. And I will open up a work session on House Bill 2100.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2100 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Burley moves House Bill 2100 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Okay. Those of the opinion that House Bill 2100 should be reported to the floor with a due pass recommendation will vote aye. Those opposed vote no. The clerk will call the roll.
Representative Smith, excuse. Representative Byer? Aye. Representative Jensen, excuse. Representative Burley?
Aye.
Representative Cannon? Aye. Representative McPherson? Aye. Chair Dingfelder? Aye.
The motion, having received the required majority, is declared passed. And I will also entertain a motion for the consent calendar for this bill, unless anyone really wants to carry it.
Madam Chair, I move that House Bill 2100 be placed on the consent calendar.
Representative Burley moves that House Bill 2100 be placed on the consent calendar. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? I'm going to do that instead of calling the roll. Okay, seeing none. The motion, having received the required majority, is declared passed. And with that, I will close the work session on House Bill 2100. And I will also close the Committee on House Energy and Environment.
All right.